right. Well, you know what's fixing to happen next, so go ahead and get your Bibles ready. And I will say, turn with me, if you will, to the place where this week's Torah portion begins. And it is the Parsha that has, this word in the first sentence, anyway. And the chapter, by the way, is chapter 30 of the book of Numbers, or Bamidbar, verse 2. So it says this, "And spoke Moshe." So Ve'yedeber Moshe, all the basically the heads, the Rosh of the tribes of the Bnei Israel, and he said the following: "This is the thing which Yahuwah has commanded." Now let's pause, because the tribes is Matot. So that's who he is speaking to. So the name of the portion is Matot. And again, it starts in Numbers chapter 30. Some of you may recall, this is one of Mark's hot buttons. I will suggest that Numbers chapter 30, on a number of fronts, particularly when it comes to what is wrong with society today, we'll talk about that, particularly when it comes to what is important to understand with respect to marriage, it's vital to that. And in terms of understanding some of the other commandments, it's vital there as well. But Numbers 30 is probably the singular place in the Torah where we see the best explanation of vows. And again, I always will go through this in some detail. A lot of times I spend more time talking about this. Normally when we read through the Torah every year and we talk about, well, let's go into some more detail on some parts, I will try to say, okay, well, I talked about that last year, or we've talked about that a lot, and I might not spend as much time on it. But this is the exception, because Numbers 30 is just so vitally important to understand. It is completely overlooked by much of Christianity today, partly because it's politically incorrect. How dare the Creator of the universe actually protect women by giving them an additional layer of protection that he does not give to men? Oh, but it doesn't look politically correct. It looks like that evil patriarchy thing, because basically what it says is that a man, a husband, or father, in the case of a woman that is a young woman still at home under her father's care, he has authority over her vows. Well, how horrible that the Creator would actually say that I'm going to give a woman an additional layer of protection in the form of her husband. All right, so here is the key. And it starts right out by saying this: when a man vows a vow unto Yahuwah. Okay, so if he vows a vow to Yahuwah, right, I swear before Yah such and such. Or, now here's the key, or if he swears an oath to bind his soul with a bond. If he just says he's going to do something, essentially, and by the way, that's going to be clarified here in a minute, so listen up, listen carefully. He shall not break his word. Well, there you go. He shall do according to all that proceeds out of his mouth. I mean, it's pretty blunt, it's pretty clear, pretty simple, pretty unequivocal. A man shall do according to all that proceeds out of his mouth, period. End of story. Now, you know, think about it. You've heard this. I usually mention it. There was a time when it was true in this country that a man's word was his bond, period. Somebody gave you their word on something, you could count on it. You think that's true nowadays? Where we got people in Oval Offices committing treason and saying, I'm going to get the FBI and the CIA to lie and to make war on the American people, and to hell with my word, to hell with the oath I took before God and put my hand on a Bible? Folks, we live in a nation that is deservedly cursed because it has so-called leadership that isn't, that doesn't give a damn about what the Creator of the universe and author of Scripture says a man is supposed to do. Of course, arguably, those people that were traitors aren't men anyway. It's real true. If they do not honor their word, they are not men, period. Okay, back to the story, though, because it's going to make a distinction. This is the politically incorrect part with women. When a woman vows a vow unto Yahuwah and she binds herself by a bond, well, now we're going to get more than one case. Case A, if she's in her father's house in her youth. In other words, she's still at home, she's still under her father's covering. And her father hears her vow, or her bond, wherewith she's bound her soul. And her father holds his peace at her. In other words, he doesn't cast it down, he doesn't say anything. Then it says, all her vows shall stand, just like a man. She's on her own. He hasn't covered her or hasn't cast the vow down. All her vows shall stand, and every bond wherewith she has bound her soul shall stand. But if her father disallow her, here's the key, on the day that he hears it, on the days that he hears it, none of her vows or her bonds wherewith she's bound her soul shall stand. And Yahuwah will forgive her. You see why this is a blessing? it irritates me when I hear the quote-unquote feminists say, oh, this is politically incorrect because how dare the God of the Bible draw a distinction, male and female, he created them. Women are supposed to be equal. The hell they are. That's a lousy deal. And furthermore, he gives women additional protection. What are they complaining about? Okay? He, the Father, has cast down his daughter's vow, and Yahuwah will forgive her because her father disallowed her. Now, then we get the second case. How about if she's older? She's now married. If she's married to a husband while her vows are upon her, or the clear utterance of her lips wherewith she has bound her soul. And we're going to see an almost identical situation. This time it's her husband. If he hears it, whatsoever day it be that he hears it, and if he holds his peace at her, well then, likewise, her vow shall stand. Her bonds wherewith she has bound her soul shall stand. So the husband had better speak up if he wants to cast it down. But if her husband disallows her in the day that he hears it, then he shall make void her vow which is upon her, and the clear utterance of her lips, wherewith she has bound her soul, and Yahuwah will forgive her. Now let's pause there for a second, because I'm going to make another observation. And I occasionally hearken back when we had a rule of law in this country, back when we had a constitution. Constitution makes more than one reference to what was called the English Common Law. You probably have heard of a book, well, and not if you were in school in the last few years, but once upon a time there was a well-known treatise called Blackstone's Commentaries on the Common Law, and it was the laws of England. And, of course, all the English-speaking countries of the world, the United States and Australia and New Zealand, all have this common law, and it's incorporated in the Constitution. Now, one of the things that's interesting that's in there, you'll actually see this, the common law says that if a woman who has a husband, let's say she goes out, she enters into a contract to buy land. She binds her soul with a vow. She's made a contract to buy land. Did you know the common law says there's a 3-day right of rescission? In other words, it's 3 days before that contract is enforceable, because the Bible says she's got that day and the husband can cast it down. He may not hear about it the first day. Suppose he hears about it the second day. Now, the assumption is we can't wait forever. Eventually, he's going to find out. But once he hears it, the husband can cast down her vow. So the common law actually says, we understand that. The woman's contract is not enforceable if her husband casts it down. Isn't that interesting? Here's a place where, when we had a rule of law in this country, it was actually in accord with Scripture. Now, it says there's a but here. The but is, how about if we're talking about a widow, woman whose husband has died, or someone who has put away and given a certificate. In other words, she no longer has a living husband, divorcee, but garasha is the Hebrew word here. Then everything that she has bound her soul by shall stand against her. In other words, she is like a man in this situation. She makes a vow, she better go through with it. She better keep it. Now, if a woman vows in her husband's house or binds her soul by a bond with an oath, and her husband hears it, and he holds his peace at her, and he does not disallow her, then all her vows shall stand, and every bond by which she has bound her soul shall stand. So you notice, this is it sounds a little bit redundant. What Scripture is doing is telling us the same thing more than one way, and I will contend that gives you an indication of how important this is. Because he is making it really, really clear. Let's take a look at it from several different directions. We got more than one special case here. We're going to talk about the special cases, and we're going to repeat it, and it's going to be real obvious. Husband has authority over the vows. If he casts them down, they're gone. She gets forgiven by Yah. But if he does not, then they stand. And if she's a divorcee or someone who does not have a husband, she's a widow, then again, her vows stand. But, verse 13, if her husband makes them null and void in the day that he hears them, then whatever proceeded out of her lips, whether it was her vows or the bond of her soul, it shall not stand. Her husband has made them void, and Yahuwah will forgive her. Every vow, every binding oath to afflict the soul, her husband can either let it stand, or her husband may make it void. That's about as clear as it can get. If the woman makes a vow, her husband can cast it down, he can let it stand. Now, this is the place where I usually pause, and I'll do that here as well, because there are any number of places where this is vitally important to understand. I would suggest that in a marital relationship, it is vitally important to understand that the husband has authority over his wife's vows, and furthermore, and over his daughter's too, while she's in his house, while she's in her youth. But there's some important examples. Let's just suppose that she says something like, you know, so long as I live, I'll never trust another man. I'll never do such and such. If I hear the words coming from my wife that says, I'll never, my ears perk up, right? Because you got to make sure that it's important and that it's not something that she's going to regret. If she's going to regret it, I'm going to cast it down. Same thing goes for a daughter. Don't have a daughter. But, you know, the example I usually give is if a little girl comes home from school and she says, Daddy, Daddy, Tommy was mean to me, and as long as I live, I'll never like another boy. All right? That's the kind of thing that, you know, we might say, well, that's just little kids. That's trivial. I want to suggest, no, that's a lot more important. And the father has not only an obligation, but he had better cast that down to protect his little girl. Because that might come back literally to haunt her. I'll never trust another man. I'll never... Those are the kind of vows that people speak that end up causing problems years later in life. And you know what? When the husband hears that, okay, the father didn't know about it. Maybe he never cast it down. Maybe he failed to cast it down. But at the point, I will contend, where now this young girl goes off, she's grown up, she has a husband, and she's, you know, something comes up, and they pray about it. The husband is informed. You know, when I was a kid, I made this vow. Maybe that's why I don't trust you men. He says, well, what was the vow, sweetheart? She says, well, you know, I vowed that I'd never love another man. Maybe that's part of the problem here. I just don't trust you, don't love you. Well, then the husband has every authority, and he should, cast it down. Get rid of that thing. Heal the relationship. So these are really important tools. They're things that I encourage husbands and wives to not only know, but understand and recognize their blessings if we will employ them in the way that the Creator gave them to us to be used. So, every vow, every binding oath to afflict her soul, her husband may let it stand, or he may make it void. But, if he altogether holds his peace at her from day to day, then he causes all her vows to stand, or all her bonds which are upon her, he has let them stand, because he held his peace on the day that he heard them. I guess there are probably just some guys that are weenies, right? I'm afraid if I cast down her vow, she'll be mean to me, or she'll cut me off, or she might yell at me, or I don't know what, but that's a lousy excuse for letting your wife suffer because you don't have enough cojones to cast down a vow that should be cast down. But if he makes them null and void, now hear this and make sure we understand it, because there is a caveat, right? But if he shall make them null and void after he has heard them, then what? He shall bear her torahlessness. He bears the guilt. He is the one who takes that upon himself. So, guys, suck it up. We have the authority, we have the duty to take those vows upon ourselves, and yes, we will bear the iniquity from them. Thankfully, and here's part of the pattern, the Creator has given us a way too, that He can take our burdens and the guilt from us as well by His shed blood, and it is a very similar understanding. Right? We're under that kind of authority. So as long as we understand the lines of authority and the processes and the things that he's put in place, all of this is for our blessing. But when we ignore it or pretend that it's done away with, we are missing out on some very important stuff. These, it says, are the statutes. Remember the word here, hukim, which Yahuwah commanded Moshe, between a man and his wife, or between a father and his daughter, being in her youth in her father's house. So Numbers 30, vitally important. Now, chapter 31 takes us back to the story, the continuing saga, and what's going to happen with Moshe. Yahuwah spoke to Moshe, and he said, avenge the B'nai Israel of the Midianites. Afterward, you shall be gathered to your people. So, Moshe, it's coming to an end for you. So, the Midianites, remember, we had this story with Bilaam, and the story of the Midianites, and of course, Pinchas, and Zimri, and Cozbi, and all the nastiness that happened, and all the idolatry, and the 24,000 that died by the plague. And now it's time for a comeuppance. This is kind of like what we're seeing today. When people commit acts that are deserving of punishment, you better make sure it happens. And Yah is not a slackard in that regard. He says the following, avenge you. This is a commandment, right? Vengeance is mine, says Yahuwah. Well, here it is. It's time. Moshe spoke to the people, and he said, "Arm yourselves, you men, from among you for war, that they may go against Midian to execute the vengeance of Yahuwah on Midian. Of every tribe, 1,000, throughout all the tribes of Israel, shall you send to the war." So it's not everybody. Remember, there's 600,000+ that are men able to go to war. So this is only going to be 12,000 out of 600,000. This is a relatively small force, but it's obviously big enough. So they were delivered out of the thousands of Israel, 1,000 of every tribe, 12,000 armed for war. Moshe sent them, 1,000 of every tribe. Notice he's repeated that now 3 times. To the war, them along with, who else? Going to war, ironically, a Kohen. Now, Kohanim don't normally go to war, but in this case, the guy with the covenant of peace, Pinchas, son of Eleazar the Kohen, he is going with them to the war, with the holy vessels and the trumpets for the alarm in his hand. Isn't that interesting? Okay, I guess what I'm going to conclude from this is the guy who committed an act of, you might say, violence in order to kill Zimri and Cozbi, and in the process stay the plague and save who knows how many thousands, maybe tens of thousands of lives, he gets the covenant of peace. There is a time when the Creator says, go out and kick butt and take names. This is one of them. So they warred against Midian, as Yahuwah commanded Moshe, and they slew every male. This is total war. They slew the kings of Midian, along with the rest of their slain, Evi, and Rechem, and Zur, and Hur, and Reba, the 5 kings of Midian. Oh yeah, and remember this other guy? Balaam, the son of Beor, they also slew Becherev. He didn't get the edge of the sword, even as a normal good person would. He got just slain with the sword. Kind of like, dying the coward's death. He is the singular exception among the people of his ilk who suffer that kind of a death with the sword as opposed to by the mouth of the sword. Now, this is a guy that was a prophet who had spoken the words of Yahuwah. He blew it big time. And by the way, we're going to get an explanation from Moshe in here. We've already talked about it, but understand, this is important. The children of Israel, they took captive the women of Midian and their little ones and all their cattle and all their flocks and all their goods they took for a prey. So this is often called the spoils of war. All right. Well, I would say so far so good, but it's going to turn out not to be so far so good. And in all their cities and the places where they dwelt, all their encampments, they burnt with fire. So all these places that they basically conquered, they burned with fire. They took all the spoil and all the prey, both of man and of beast. They brought the captives and the prey and the spoil unto Moshe and unto Eleazar the priest and the congregation of the children of Israel into the camp, unto the plains of Moab, which are there by the river Jordan at Jericho. Moshe and Eleazar the priest and all the princes of the congregation went forth to meet him outside the camp. So here comes the returning army of 12,000. And Moshe was, he was what? Yeah, he was PO'd. He was wroth with the officers of the host, the captains of thousands and the captains of hundreds who came from the service of the war. He was PO'd. Why? And he said to them, "Have you saved all of the women alive?" Well, yeah, there's some good-looking women in here. Remember, these were the women we were making hubba-hubba. Yeah, there's the problem, dudes. "Behold," says Moses, "these are the ones that caused the children of Israel." And by the way, who gave him the advice? If we had any doubts, Moses removes it here. "Through the counsel of Balaam." Yeah, I can't curse them. But you women, you can get them to curse themselves. And we all know how that works now, don't we? "To revolt so as to break faith with Yahuwah in the matter of Peor." And that was the reason why the plague was among the congregation of Yahuwah. Moses is not happy. You saved a whole bunch of these women alive. What are you going to do about it? "Now, therefore," he says, "kill every male among the little ones." What? This is hardcore stuff. All right, we read this and we go, oh, this is really nasty. No, when it comes to severe idolatry and things that are, I would argue that what we're really talking about here is corruption of a bloodline. And he says every single male, I don't care how old they are, every single male is going to die. "Kill every woman too that is not a virgin. Every woman that has known man by lying with him." She got all these women that were out there doing the dirty deed with God. Kill them all. Now, the women, children, in other words, the really young children that are girls, young girls, that have not known man, young girls that are virgins by lying with him, keep alive for yourselves. They're going to be spoil of war. But it's only the young women who are virgins. Camp with outside the camp for 7 days. Why? Because you all have committed some acts of death. You've got blood on your hands. So whoever's killed anyone, whoever's touched anyone who has been slain, purify yourselves. Remember, this is the commandment of Yahuwah. You've touched a dead body. You're going to need to be cleaned up on the third day and on the seventh day. Also, you and your captives. Now, as to every garment, everything that's made out of skin, so you basically got your cattle skins, your leather, your goat skins, and so forth, any garments that are made out of that, all the work of goat's hair, anything's made of wood, you shall purify. And Eleazar the priest said unto the men of war that went to the battle, this is the statute, the hook of HaTorah, which Yahuwah has commanded Moshe. Okay, going to clean these things up. Now, the stuff that's made out of the heavy metals, the precious metals, the gold, the silver, the brass, the iron, the tin, and the lead, on the other hand, that, everything that can abide the fire, in other words, these things can go through the fire and be purified by fire. That's what we're going to do. Those things shall be made to go through the fire, and then they will be clean. Nevertheless, it shall be purified with the water of sprinkling. So I'm still going to sprinkle it with water once it's done going through the fire. Now, all the other things that can't handle going through the fire, right, the things that are made out of cloth or woody, we've already talked about, other things, though, that would burn up, they won't go through the fire, so you make them instead go through the water. And you shall wash all your clothes on the seventh day, and then you shall be clean. After that, you can come back into the camp. And then it says, Yahuwah spoke to Moshe, and he said, take the sum, okay, count up all of the prey, all of the spoil that was taken, both of man and of beast, you, along with Eleazar the priest, and the heads of the fathers' houses of the Adat, the congregation. And then divide the prey into two parts. Okay, so we've got the spoils of war, and what happens, this is kind of the standard practice in a conquering situation. There are what are called spoils of war. You'll hear the term prize is also used, sometimes at sea. But this is basically ancient law. The spoils of war belong to the victor. But we're going to do this today. We're going to divide the prey into two different parts. Okay, part will go to the men who were skilled in the war that went out to battle. Okay, so those that actually fought for it, they get part of it, and the rest of the congregation gets the other part of it. A levy a tribute unto Yahuwah out of the men of war that went out to battle. Okay, so Yah's going to get a piece of their tribute, the men of war who went to battle. One soul out of every 500. So we got some women that are going to survive, right? One out of 500 of them will go to Yahuwah. Both of the persons, and of the beeves, and of the asses, and of the flock. So you got some goats, and some sheep, and some cattle, and one out of 500 of all of those will go to Yah. Take it out of their half, okay, the half of those who went to war. Give it to Eleazar the priest as a portion set apart for Yah. So basically, Eleazar and the Kohanim get the part that is set aside to Yah. Now, of the children of Israel's half, you take a bigger share, right? They didn't earn it as much. They're just going to take a piece. So this time, Yah gets one out of 50 of the persons, the beeves, the asses, the flocks, all the cattle. You give those also to the Levites, those that keep charge of the tabernacle of Yahuwah. So Moshe and Eleazar the priest did as Yahuwah commanded Moshe. Now the prey, over and above the booty which the men of war took, was, this is a lot of stuff, folks, listen to this, 675,000 sheep. 675,000 sheep. 312, in other words, 72,000 beeves, 61,000 asses, and a total of 32,000 persons in all of the women virgins. So 32,000 virgin women. This was a huge spoil. Now, and ask yourself one more question, right? How many men went to war? 1,000 from each of 12 tribes. They got almost three times more many virgin women, girl captives, than they do guys who went to war, not to mention all those guys that were destroyed. This was a pretty lopsided victory. Obviously, when they go to war on behalf of Yah, they do kick butt and take names. Now, the half, which was the portion of them that went out to war, okay, so their share, the warrior share, was in number 330,000. 7,500 sheep. Wow. 337,500 sheep. Yahuwah's tribute of the sheep was 675. Now the beeves, there were 36,000 of those, which Yahuwah's tribute was 72. The asses, there were 30,500. The part that went to Yah was 61. The persons, 16,000, remember about half, of whom Yahuwah's tribute was 32, and Moshe gave that tribute, which was set apart unto Yahuwah, to Eleazar the priest, as Yahuwah commanded Moshe. Of the children of Israel's half, which Moshe divided off from the men that went to war, now the congregation's half was 337,500 sheep, 36,000 beeves, 30,500 asses and 16,000 persons. This is an amazing amount of stuff that they got. Even of the children of Israel's half, Moshe then took one drawn out of every 50, both a man and a beast. He gave them to the Levites that kept charge of the tabernacle, the Mishkan of Yahuwah, as Yahuwah commanded Moshe. Now the officers that were over the thousands of the host and the captains of thousands and the captains of hundreds came near unto Moshe, and here's what they said. Your servants have taken the sum of the men of war that are under our charge. And you know what? We're not missing one man. There lacks not one man of us. Isn't that amazing? And we've brought the offering to Yahuwah, what every man has gotten, jewels of gold, armlets, bracelets, signet rings, earrings, girdles, to make atonement for our souls before Yahuwah. So Moshe and Eleazar took the priest, took the gold, all the wrought jewels, all the gold of the gift that they set apart for Yahuwah, of the captains of thousands and the captains of hundreds, and all of that amounted to 16,750 shekels. That's a huge pile of booty there. For the men that have taken booty, every man for himself. And it says, Moshe and Eleazar the priest took the gold of the captains of thousands and of hundreds and brought it into the tent of meeting for a memorial for the B'nai Israel before Yahuwah. All right. Now we're going to get one more chapter here that kind of wraps up the portion. This one is another one of those that's kind of interesting, and it's going to play out as we see through the rest of the story, having to do with the places where we're going to find various of the tribes and on which side of the Jordan. And it's kind of an interesting story for several reasons. So we'll go through it. It goes like this. Now it says the children of Reuben. Remember, Reuben's the firstborn. The children of Gad. These were cattlemen. They had a lot of cattle. And when they saw the land of Yazer and the land of Gilead, well, look, now there's a lot of grass. This is great grasslands. This was a really good place for cattle. So they decided, you know, this is great land. We'd like this. So the children of Gad and the children of Reuben came, and they spoke to Moshe and to Eleazar the priest and the princes of the Edah of the congregation. They said the following, Ataroth and Dibon and Yazer and Nimron, Heshbon, Eleale and Sabam and Nebo and Baon, the land which Yahuwah smote before the congregation of Israel, the land that they just took, in other words, it's a great place for cattle. And your servants, you know, hey, have you noticed? We got a lot of cattle. And they said, look, if we have found favor in your sight, let this land be given to your servants for a possession. We don't need to go on the other side of the Jordan. Now, pause. Okay, because there's two ways you can listen to this and read it, right? We're going to see that we got to be real careful here. And this almost gets misconstrued. So Moshe then says to the children of Gad and to the children of Reuben, wait a minute, so shall your brethren go out to war while you, basically, I'm going to paraphrase just a bit, while you just sit here on your asses? Is that what you're asking? You can see he's almost getting ready to get a little PO'd. So will you then turn away the heart of the children of Israel from going over into the land which Yahuwah has given them? Oh, guess what he's thinking? Oh, you don't have to guess. He's going to tell you. That's what your fathers did when I sent them to Kadesh Barnea to spy out the land. They went up into the valley of Eshcol. They saw the land. They turned away the heart of the B'nai Israel. Remember, they brought home an evil report that they didn't want to go into the land which Yahuwah had given them. And you know what? Yahuwah's anger was kindled in that day, and he swore, saying the following. So Moshe's going to tell them what he said, and just in case they didn't remember. Surely none of those men that came up out of Egypt, from 20 years old and upward, not one of them shall see the land which I swore unto Abraham, Isaac, and to Yaakov, because they have not wholly followed me. Well, except for the two, and he's going to name them, you know them, Caleb, son of Jephunneh the Kenizzite, and Joshua, son of Nun, because they have wholly followed Yahuwah. And he says, he wasn't done yet, Yahuwah's anger was kindled against Israel. He made them wander to and fro in the wilderness for 40 years, till every single one of that generation, all of those that had done evil in the sight of Yahuwah, were consumed. They died. Their carcasses, as promised, fell in the wilderness. And behold, here you are, risen up in your father's stead, a brood of sinful men. Moses is, he's on a roll. He is some kind of PO'd. A brood of sinful men to augment yet again the fierce anger of Yahuwah toward Israel. Because look at this. If you turn away from after him, he will yet again leave them in the wilderness, and so you will destroy all of this people. Okay, you think the sons of Reuben and of Gad are sufficiently chastened at this point? Now, you got to wonder, and I'll admit, when I read the story, it's not like Moses to misread intentions too much. So I have a strong suspicion there was a grain of truth in what he was saying. But I also have a pretty strong suspicion that these guys immediately turned on their heels and go, oh, no, 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 oh, time out here. No, no, don't think that at all. That's not even remotely what we were implying. Okay? Is exactly that how it played out, or was there some change of heart? We're not sure. But they do say the following. They came near unto Moshe, and they said, look, we will build sheepfolds here for our cattle and cities for our little ones. But we ourselves, we are not going to shirk our duty. No, no how, no way. We ourselves, we are ready to go armed to battle before the children of Israel until we have brought them unto their place, and our little ones will dwell in the fortified cities because the inhabitants of the land. Okay, so we're going to leave our little kids here. You know, they don't need to go to battle. But don't worry, we will go to battle. And matter of fact, we will lead into the battle. We will not return unto our houses until the children of Israel, every man has inherited his inheritance. All right, now we're talking. We're going to go do what we need to do. We're just asking that we be allowed to have the inheritance here. We like this land. But as far as doing our duty, don't think for a second. We're not going to go out and kick some butt and take names. We will lead the charge. Because we do not want to inherit. We will not inherit with them on the other side of the Jordan, on the other side of the river, and forward. Because our inheritance, at least that's what they're asking, is fallen to us on this side of the Jordan to the east. Okay, so they're asking for the east side of the Jordan. Now, if you look at the maps, you'll see the maps that, you know, in the end of the Bible, you know, you've got your Genesis to maps. The maps will show these places on the east side of the river where the children of Reuben and of Gad, and as it turns out, one more, the half-tribe of Manasseh, is going to be over there too. And this was a deal they worked out. So Moses said the following. Here's the deal. If, there's a key word, right? Eam. If, and that's a big if you will do this thing, if you will arm yourselves to go before Yahuwah to the war, every armed man of you, every single one of you, will pass over the Jordan before Yahuwah until he has driven out his enemies from before him, and the land is subdued before Yahuwah, and then after that you return, then you shall be clear before Yahuwah and before Israel. And this land, you got it, shall be unto you for a possession before Yahuwah. That's the deal. You go do all of this, you return, you've honored your word. There it is, right? Isn't it interesting? In Numbers 30, you had better do, every man of you, as you have spoken. No wonder. It's a demonstration of what we're talking about here. This land would then be yours for a possession before Yahuwah. But if you will not do so, behold, you have sinned against Yahuwah, and no, your sin will find you. Build your cities for your little ones. Build your sheepfolds for your sheep. And here we go. Do that which has proceeded out of your mouth. The children of Gad and the children of Reuben spoke to Moshe, and they said, your servants will do as my Lord commands. Our little ones, our wives, our flocks, our cattle, we'll leave them here. They'll be here in the cities of Gilead. But your servants, that's us, will pass over, every man of us armed for war, before Yahuwah to battle, as my Lord says. So, Moshe gave charge concerning them to Eleazar the priest, and to Joshua son of Nun, and the heads of the fathers' houses of the tribes of the Bnei Israel. And Moshe said to them, "Look, if the children of Gad and the children of Reuben will pass with you over the Jordan, every man armed for battle before Yahuwah, and the land shall be subdued before you." In other words, they're going to do it. You got to take the land. It's part of the deal. "Then you shall give them the land of Gilead for a possession. But if they will not do that, they won't pass over with you armed, they shall have possessions among you in the land of Canaan." They want this land, they better go over. But if they won't, then the possessions. He's not taking away their possession, notice. But it's in the land of Canaan. "Now the children of Gad and the children of Reuben answered, and they said, 'As Yahuwah has said unto your servants, we shall do. We will pass over armed.'" You notice how clear this is being made? All right, this story is now, you know, we're going to, here's what you're going to do. Yes, that's what we're going to do. We're going to repeat it. It is really, really clear. Both sides of this contract, understand, this is what you've said. We're going to repeat it back to you. And that is what you heard, right? Yep, yep. That's what we said. That's what you heard. I repeated it back to you. No doubt about it. "We will pass over armed before Yahuwah in the land of Canaan, and the possession of our inheritance shall remain with us beyond the Jordan, east of the Jordan. So Moshe gave unto them, even to the children of Gad and to the children of Reuben." Now here we get this one addition. It's the first time we see this show up. But it turns out, it looks like the children of Manasseh, at least some of them, about half of them, said, you know, we like the deal too. We want part of that. We like this land. So unto the half tribe of Manasseh as well. So half of Manasseh is on one side, half on the other side of the river when it all ends up. "The son of Joseph," so Manasseh, son of Joseph, "the kingdom of Sihon, king of the Amorites, and the kingdom of Og, king of Bashan, the land, according to the cities thereof, with their borders, the cities of land round about. The children of Gad, they built places, Dibon, Ataroth, and Aror, and Atrot, Shofan, and Yazer, and Yogbeha, and Bet Nimrah, and Bet Haran, fortified cities, folds for their sheep. Now the children of Reuben, they built Heshbon, and Eleah, and Kiriat Ataim, and Nebo, and Baal Meon, although they changed those names, and Sibma, and they gave their names unto the cities which they built. The children of Machir, son of Manasseh, they went to Gilead, and they took it, and they dispossessed the Amorites that were therein. And Moshe gave Gilead to Machir, the son of Manasseh, and he dwelt there." So here's this half-tribe, the son of Machir, Machir the son of Manasseh, and he is going to dwell in that part of the land. "Yair the son of Manasseh went, and he took villages, and he called them Havot Yair after himself. And Nobah went, and he took Kenat and the villages thereof, and he called it Nobah after his own name." So at this point, what we're seeing is the division of the land is not complete yet, but at least those two and a half tribes have decided they want the land on the east side, the best cattle land, the grassland, and they are agreeing. No uncertain terms. They will fight, and they will continue to fight until every other man gets their jaw, their own possession, and then they will return to the land that they have then earned. So with that, that ends the Torah portion, and it's interesting. It begins and it ends with this idea of a man shall do according to all that proceeds out of his mouth, and I sure wish that were so. I'm going to encourage folks, understand that that is the way it needs to be. And that is the way that a man behaves, and that is the way that honest people still do. And sadly, that is not what we see out of so much of the swamp and out of so much of America with a K nowadays.